And to give you a sense of how we might begin a conversation, we have a microphone here at my right, and you are welcome to begin to think about questions you'd like to ask our panelists. I've also asked them to withhold some things that they just were dying to say in the constraints that I gave them that were purposeful, and I might be asking them as well. But please feel free to raise hands. If you're not comfortable coming up here, that's fine. You can pose your questions from the audience. I'll just repeat them back. Remind me to repeat it back if I haven't, so that everyone can hear. And with that said, we're turning up the lights a little bit, and now we're shifting into the next 30-40 minutes of this conversation. Now, before I jump in, I was wondering if any of our panelists have questions for each other. One of the things I might just do, just so we can refresh our memories, is to have maybe Reina and Odin and Jennifer just give a brief description of some of the works that they actually looked at, and the way that they're thinking about space, because this is one of the points of the panel, is to see how space gets reconfigured, both historically in practices by artists who are cited, C-I-T-E, in some of the works in Phantom Sightings. So I was very keen to have Reina talk about this very interesting pairing both of, say, Ken Gonzalez Day and Cristina Fernandez, and how it points back to, you mentioned her briefly, but perhaps you might want to say a couple more words about Ana Mendieta, because I think that there are links between this idea of leaving an imprimatur or leaving some kind of evidence, testimony of lived practices, be they the kind of rituals that Ana Mendieta was doing, performing both in Mexico and other places, to leave evidence of her own physical body and so forth.
I'm actually kind of intrigued by this idea of inscription, and even after hearing Ondine's piece
with the
graffiti, that, you know, I think because there is, I mean, this is not to just essentialize it because, you know, you're displaced or because you're aside, away from your homeland, but I think it's this kind of need to leave a mark, right? You want to be known, you want to like leave a legacy, and how do you leave those marks, right? So it's, I don't think that desire is only something that Chicano or Latino artists or even us Latinos do. It's just, you always have this desire to leave a mark. We're fortunate that because it's, you know, Mendieta's work was also ephemeral, but she was also very, you know, coming from practice of performance and durational, that you needed to have that documentation, right? And thank goodness that she was thoughtful of that, because now we have something to refer to. But I'm thinking about this inscription of self to land, because then there's a way that Ken Gonzalez Day photographs disrupts that, right? Because, I mean, formalistically, or just the image itself, is this beautiful photograph of an oak tree. But then it really begs us to become participant, in some ways witnesses, to this history that you cannot now ignore, but you don't know about the history of lynching, and now you don't know the history of lynching of Mexicanos. I mean, he's not giving us the whole, you know, breakdown of it, but we now have to become complicit and become witness. And he does that also in the installation now at St. James Park. So it's an interesting question, right, that you want to leave presence. How do you document something that's so elusive, and yet, you know, you flip it?
It's interesting, though, that they both, that is Cristina and Ken, use what might be considered a formalist image, as you've expressed, right? There is this tree that is appealing because of a whole tradition of landscape photography,
right,
or in the case of Cristina, of urban formalist takes, Louis Baltz, yeah, the new topography, for example, and yet it is research-based so that it posits the viewer in a position where we're both anxious about enjoying the visual object in front of us, which is very appealing, and having to rethink our pleasure in that enjoyment, right?
Right, and rethink our positionality,
also does this wonderful work of making us rethink all landscape photography that we've seen before. In other words, it says, you haven't been thinking necessarily about the history of the land when you're looking at the tradition of landscape in the United States, just to take one example, because the history of the land in the United States is about domination and extermination. And that history is precisely alighted in the Hudson School and all of the traditions of landscape production fairly up until the 20th century. And I think that it actually has to then to rethink when you see that space. And I think that's one of the strong elements of the work.
I think this is a link that all three presenters, and since you've spoken with Jennifer, I'll ask you to talk about, because Audine did this as well, and I'll ask him next, of linking a kind of practice that is historically anchored in a certain way, and then re-enchanting it, so that when Casas is using the idea of the vehicle is now has, in the current economic realism, has very different connotations, and I think you tease that out very strongly. Maybe you might want to say something about, and you did already, but about the way in which sexuality is invested in that commodity item that Cabrera is clearly exploiting, right?
Well, I think that there's... I would just like to say that it would be lovely to have more time. I tried to keep my comments to a little constrained.
That was my fault. But see, now I'm giving more time.
I only got to talk about those two images, but...
Would you have talked about others?
Well, I'm particularly... Thank you. I was too much. Thank you for that. It seemed I was very moved by the trail of the automobile throughout this show. And there's a way, not only from the freeway mural references, the forms of reconstruction of automobiles to hide border crossing, which is incredibly moving, the way in which there's this effort to try to understand the, if you will, the spatial imaginaries, as I suggested in my talk, of the automobile, but it's also a set of questions about the production of wealth. And there's a way in which we often ignore the production of wealth in relationship to the automobile and these cross-border economies. And yet, from many different vantage points, not just within the Chicano community and the people who maybe identify with family members or traditions of cross-border labor practices and importation, et cetera, and exportation, but obviously the way it affects the U.S. economy generally. And I think that it's an error to think about what's happening with the automobile in this exhibit as somehow limited to Chicano issues or sort of like, you know, issues. I mean, the issues that are being raised here are broader issues. And I think, anyway, that's one thing I'm trying to suggest as well. And I'm not sure if I really answered your question.
No, you did.
Okay.
And that leads into, I think, an idea about legality, which is what you were bringing up, Mondine, in terms of that these works also speak to and address policymaking, with it, be it in the urban environment or at a national level or binational level, which is what you were just saying, Jennifer. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how, to what degree that kind of regulation, civic regulation, activated in models of response or willful appropriation, so that we have this shift from what was kind of having to aggressively name and inscribe a space, as Raina was saying, and then using the history of that inscription in much more in ways that involve new media, for example, these virtual writings getting morphed in all kinds of different ways, of this mobile vehicle as well that's taking to other spaces that would not have had access to that environment.
Well, I think, you know, fundamentally what I'm interested in are these spatializing actions that contest the signification of public space. And one of the reasons why I was interested in the story of El Monte that I'm still very much in, I love working with these little micro-narratives, and not quite as effective at times as you are, forgive me, Jennifer, brilliant, is that I think what has been occurring is that this relationship between the Oslo artists and the alternative trajectories of Chicano art and the alternative possibilities for Chicano art that they developed have been far too often placed in a kind of adversarial relationship with the more sanctioned forms of muralism and other forms of public art practices, posters and so forth. And I'm reminded of, you know, Judy Baca writing in the 1990s and saying that, you know, muralism and graffiti were the only forms for public interventions in space in Southern California, Los Angeles specifically. So this story, and I think that Oslo, they were questioning the limitations and the ways in which both programmatically and institutionally there was this conflation of ethnicity and medium, so that, you know, the Chicano artist was by default delimited to the community service oriented mural project, which is how this project in El Monte began. And it was there not to support and promote graffiti, but rather to abate and get rid of graffiti. But so this story, of course, because there is an Oslo artist involved in this, Grant, I think it's also that these alternatives that they pursued about these different types of spatializing actions were not just critiques of the more traditional formats, but were also perhaps being forced by, that these alternatives, the performative, the mobile, were enforced because of policy, right? The fact that there was a moratorium on muralism, and this is happening in El Monte, which, what's El Monte's claim to fame? There are several, I know, but one of them is it's the first Anglo, that's the term that's used, Anglo-founded city in the state of California. And what's happening in 1976 is it's becoming a Chicano and Latino majority. So it's going through tremendous social, cultural, and demographic shifts. And the muralism becomes a sign for that shift that they need to eradicate. And I want to think about these things perhaps as these kind of reinvented possibilities that connect to this.
I wanted to quickly comment that I heard a very interesting talk recently about New Orleans. And there are new ordinances that prevent various forms of street performance and participation after Katrina, and that ordinances that were put in place have been changed with various excuses for one, but it's clearly about the containment of cultural difference and the opportunity to reinsert that containment. So it's not just a 70s issue, and this continues on in our civic life today.
Now, there might be questions. Please raise your hand if you do have questions. But I wanted to ask one more thing, since we briefly, many of you have now seen the exhibition, yes? So I'm also interested in, and Jennifer, this is tied to your scholarship, as to how space gets performed or enacted or reproduced, represented within the museum space. And I must say there are some terrific Borges, the ingenio in the way that the show is installed. For example, just the opening signage has a reference to poster art, and yet you're led to this other kind of scaffolding that represents another kind of urban space. So I think these kinds of things, maybe you've noticed, the three of you have noticed something you'd like to point out in that regard. For example, this is Jennifer and I were talking about. About the King Gonzales Day installation, for example, the sea. Maybe I'll let you talk about that. Or Reina, did you have a response?
What am I talking about? Well, actually, I want to ask, let me put it back to you. How is it that you felt walking through that piece? Because it was very interesting in the setup where you have, you know, the black and white photograph, and then you have this, you know, Mylar negative of it. And when you see it, you see the black and white photograph. You don't see the negative of it, right? And it was, I think, a very interesting setup. So how did you feel you were involved within that space? Like, was it about an affiliation between one side or another, or what was that connection? I think I want to ask you guys that.
I felt very much included. more eerie.
Yes. And there's also, because one is reflected in it at different moments, as are the smaller pieces are reflected in it, depending on the light and the position. And then I found myself, so one's placed not only as witness slash participant, but also witnessing the other people that are in the room reflected back in it as well. So it very much was a kind of multi-layered relationship.
I was just going to say that the image, however, is, I believe we're certainly above head level of the people in the room, right? Am I correct? So we're not actually on eye level with the spectators. We might actually be more on eye level with the
yes.
And so I think that that might be an interesting way to go back into the space and think about whether we're implicated in that position.
Right.
Not just the witness, but the one who suffers.
And you have to get very close because some of the postcards, for example, are flipped and you have to see the other side. And
right.
It is about which side are you looking from, right?
And how you enter that space, right? Either you enter that space by looking at these postcards, and so you have the context and then this, you know, this narrative of this moment or these events that happened in this nation. Or if you enter the other space, you're the one walking towards
right.
the news, right? And it becomes interesting. And I mean, either way, though, I think there's a way that installation really, you know, there's no easy way out of it. You have to really recognize how you participate within that. And I think it's interesting because it makes us aware of these places that have these stories, you know. And yet we may not be familiar with them, but we recognize it. You know, there's this way that, why is it that we recognize this, you know, violent inscription to the landscape, but it's racial, it's gendered. Why do we recognize it? You know, what are the signs that are triggering those things?
And then the photograph outside of it, the oak tree, also, it's also just so quotidian, because although it is a specific tree, and if I remember correctly, not all of them are, you couldn't find the exact tree, it's a potential tree within the area that your historical research took you to. Is that correct?
Do you approve, Ken, of all of this happening so far?
We have Ken on the audience.
I defer to the artist. So,
thumbs up, thumbs down.
So, this violent inscription into the landscape is at once very specific,
yes.
But then also quotidian and can potentially resonate with any and every oak tree that we have in our neighborhoods. Here in southern, you know, and throughout the Southwest, actually.
I'd like to ask a question that changes the focus slightly
sure.
to the issue of invisibility and absence, because I thought that was a really useful trope that recurred, because obviously the title Phantoms, but I was also thinking about the way in which each of the talks talked about the impossibility of a subject being in a place. And even in what I was working on, the impossibility of seeing the labor that produces the object, the rendering absent of the means of production that bring about the commodity form. And I just wondered if people wanted to pursue further this question of invisibility and or absence in ways they hadn't been able to yet, or in relationship to other works in the show.
I mean, I was going to say that it is something, the angel passed over. It is that moment that Chan talked about this, and maybe Chan might want to talk about this. It's crucial to his essay, the idea that it's invisibility on at least three levels. One, that invisibility in terms of place, and invisibility in terms of the institution called contemporary art, and visibility in other ways that are not just allegorical. Right? Chan, did you want to say something?
I don't want to talk about it, I want to pose it as a question. Starting with an observation, in terms of the kind of work that Ondine's doing, he's calling microhistory. And I think he captured it absolutely right in terms of what that stands against, which is a kind of historical positioning that's purely oppositional. And what I found fascinating about the Almonte story, besides Almonte, who's also South Almonte, you know. is that what you end up with is the history of origins of the lace.
Yes.
When from another perspective of looking at lace over the last 10 years, you could say, this is an institution towards which there can be an oppositional relationship among Chicano artists, or among art that is representative or in some ways responsive of a community other than a notion of what I call a mainstream notion of an alternative arts community. And to go back, and we know some of this history in terms of the role of OSCO and the formation of it as well, but the way in which these origins get written out of the histories of institutions, public institutions as well, as they begin to play more and more of a normalizing mainstream function. So I wanted to point that out as what I think is a very fruitful direction for history of just teasing out the complexities of any origin. And then the question I wanted to pose to you and Jennifer as the art historians was something that kind of came up, that was the basis of Jennifer's, but I've seen in other contexts. And that has to do with art historical position. And again, the way in which we often work in an oppositional mode of mainstream art and Chicano art. And in particular, how do we make sense of the work done in the 60s by artists like Mel Casas or Luis Jimenez, who for all intents and purposes can be seen as pop artists, but they're not part of pop art history. And that work is also not part of Chicano art history. It just kind of hovers out there. And then you see the continuing resonance of an engagement with pop through Margarita Cabrera. I mean, so, and other artists. So how do we go back as historians? How do you unravel that? How do you retell those histories, getting away from the two models we have, which is an oppositional, and then also the kind of genealogy of direct influences, so that, oh, well, you're just derivative of people that came 5 years earlier. So, do you have any thoughts on that?
It's a conundrum for scholars, and I imagine artists as well, because you live in the world with all of the signs that are present around you, and so there's no reason why any given sign should be off limits for your use. So you should be able to reference Oldenburg, for example, or reference any other art production as an artist, no matter what your community or your ethnic identity. And I think what we're seeing at this moment is the tension that arises intellectually around the problem of giving a certain amount of credit to artists for being art historically aware, and this happens in the catalog, and yet simultaneously not wanting to simply validate them in terms of the, if you will, canon, right? So how do you manage to both show that the artists engage the canon and at the same time not privilege the canon as the thing that they ought to be referencing?
Or accept it in the history of the canon that we have.
Well, I think the question comes to precisely back to that. And I would say, this reminds me of a conversation I had with Hal Foster many years ago, where I said, well, okay, you have your history. It's a nice big book of modernism. And there are some artists I'm happy you've included. But there are some lacuna, and the question is not a question of inclusion. The question is, would the story of modernity be different if these artists that you've ignored were part of the conversation? And I think that's our critical role as scholars right now, is to actually address that point.
And to kids, I mean, I in addition to being a scholar on Chicano Latino art and the art of California more broadly, I'm also a scholar on Oldenburg and Warhol, and teach a variety of courses on pop art, where in my pop art courses at Williams College, Jimenez, Casas, Ruper Garcia are central. And the question that I always ask is, what do we learn when we pair Warhol with Ruper Garcia's work together about Chicano art, about pop art in New York, and also about kind of commercial culture and protest culture at the same time? But one of the things that happens again, and I think this is part of the transition as well, when I teach the work of Luis Jimenez, particularly with all the multi-layered references that are historical and cultural, both US American and Mexican and Mesoamerican, that the question comes up, are there too many references here? And I ask my students that as a joke, right? Is there just too much going on? And some of them will say, yes. It's too complex. I can't read every single element into this. And yet that doesn't seem to happen in the same way that it does with Oldenburg's Knacker Bread, right? I've never eaten Knacker Bread, but I can still teach those works by him. And I think one of the things that's happening now, and you've written about this quite eloquently, John, is that there was a way, because of that lack of understanding of the variety of references, historical, cultural, and vernacular, within much of the earlier work from the 60s and the 70s, even into the 80s, into the present, there was a way in which it was not read. The art historians who were could have written on this material felt that they couldn't read it properly, thus they chose not to, right? And I think what we're seeing now in the contemporary literature, I'm thinking of Jen Hoffman and several other writings on Mario Ibarra and others, is this claim with the new generation that they can attend to both the social and the formal as if that is new. And that's not the case, that, you know, Jimenez, Garcia, many others were attending to both the formal, the social, and the historical. The formal just could not be read or was obscured or ignored.
Just to kind of go back to your question about rendering the absent and then addressing what Sean just talked about, it really, there's two points to this. And one is, it really reminds me of Toni Morrison's Plain in the Dark, right, where she goes back to the canon of American literature. And she says, you know, African-American literature has always been present within American literature. But you have to look within, so to speak, the shadows, right? You have to make what is absent explicit. And the same way, I think, more often, that practice, and what Toni Morrison puts to us, is that it falls on us, those who are looking for those ghosts, right, to uncover them. And so we bring those absences to the light in some extent, or even thinking about what Bach says, that ghosting effect, right? It's like you see it, you don't see it, but you know it's there. And so in thinking about that, I like how Jeffrey said that it's like, what would be the narrative told if we were to include this? And I like that. I like that it then enriches that conversation and that discourse. And that what so far has been practiced, though, is that, you know, add, difference, mix, and then we're okay. And it's more than just adding those different stories. It's more than just, you know, recovering this history. I mean, this is what, you know, what we do. But I guess I would challenge us, you know, like Morrison, look at the canon, and you'll see that we've always been there, you know. And as we do in our courses, we make these figures central. And then, you know, it's the students may continue to look beyond that. And it's going to be this ongoing practice. But I love, unfortunately, though, it may have been, you know, there's these two trains of thought of, you know, being oppositional. I'm just like, you know, I don't want to be oppositional, but what happens when we put them next to each other? What does the juxtaposition inform? And what does it tell us, you know? Putting, you know, I love that, because if you notice that within a period, you know, all these artists were engaging with similar conversations, and that's what intrigues me by, you know, the photographs that were done by Ken and Christina. I mean, these are all done, you know, within the last 8 years, as well as Sandy and Bacco's work, and, you know, what does that moment tell us? I mean, is this about a new, you know, I mean, I don't know, it's like, I feel like these conversations are from last century, but for some reason, we need to figure out how to
engage
them now.
Can I just say, I don't know if this connects directly, but I just want to say that one of the, we go back to this thing of absence, that it's been something that I've been charting in my writing over the years. And I think for me, it became a way of understanding Osco's work both in relationship and in a crucial differentiation from the kind of more dominant practices of Chicano art at the time. And that, because I kept thinking again and again that what they were doing was marking absence, making absence palpable, rather than working from the fragment or the ruin. And the difference here, at least for me, is that the fragment and the ruin are concerned with nostalgia, concerned with melancholy, and concerned with this fugitive attempt, I suppose, to recapture or make complete a lost whole. And much of the work in this show is less about that nostalgic, melancholic longing and more about working directly in the present to imagine a future. And that's where I think the absence comes in, becomes very, marking absence becomes very, very powerful and productive, socially, politically, and aesthetically.
And just briefly, if not nostalgia, at least I think many of us who write about and create stories about this artwork find ourselves having to use the logic of negative critique or the logic of omission. It's like, oh, okay, I have to rehearse Rosalind Krauss to be able to get to, you know, the sculpture in the extended field so that I can start talking about Celia Alvarez Muñoz. But then I realize, well, what if you write it in such a way that there's not an omission, but in fact, Rosalind Krauss was writing about Celia Alvarez Muñoz all along without having known it. Right? In other words, it's switching the logic from a negative critique to a positive one. And that, I think it's a way out, and I think that's what you're asking, Charlie, of having to talk about an omission. Well, what if we act as if there really were no omission? There's a tragedy to that illusion that I actually find very appealing. And so we have a question over here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for a very interesting series of presentations. I'd like to move a little bit, if I can, away from some of the more academic realm to perhaps political and present day realms. I'm remembering a conversation I had with Tomasi Barafrastro several years ago about how revolutionary the Chicano movement was when it first came into our lives. I missed that piece of the conversation in this. The exhibition is provocatively entitled Art After the Chicano Movement, and that whole statement has been problematized by Rita in her introduction. I'm also thinking about us actually living in a very tough time right now in lots of ways, which several of you actually referred to, particularly Jennifer. Life is changing. Life is changing very rapidly. That's a very interesting observation of mine that I know. But I'm thinking more about the way in which America has been transformed, the way in which Mexico has been transformed, about the formation of hybrid cultures. I'm thinking about the demonstrations against immigration recently. I'm thinking about building triple fences at the border, et cetera, et cetera. Is the relationship between what's happening now in our material lives, our political lives, in any way connected with this, shall I say, revolution in art after the Chicano movement?
And maybe we'll take Karen Mary's question as well, and that way we can have time to, maybe we can address both questions at the same time. So this.
Well, unfortunately, my question takes it back to the academic, I think.
I'll make them work.
It's your job. Well, I'm so glad to be at the museum. Thank you for the wonderful papers, Jennifer. You gave us a methodology for how to pair these kinds of works. I think answers John's question, but I wanted to add another point to that because my heart's actually pounding, and I think it's because this is like my third Chicano Day at the museum in the last month. You know. No, fourth. Two at LACMA, two at the Getty, if I can invoke the other museum across town. So bear with me because my heart's pounding. It's so wonderful.
I think that is a good thing.
Yes, it's wonderful to be Chicano Day at the museum. They should have it more often. That's for you for being here on Saturday. So my question is, or my comment is, you know, thank you, Chon, for talking about the works that are hovering outside of Chicano art historiography. But I think there's a third way of, it's not just the oppositional, it's not just derivative. I think there's another paradigm, and it's the one that comes from U.S. third world feminist scholarship and activists who said that we're multiple, that we have multiplicities, that our subjectivity is not just a singular. So maybe, in fact, my comment is to the second panel, the language of reject a narrowly defined notion of, and then you can fill in the blank. I think we've missed, you know, that scholarship, that activism that's hovering outside, is U.S. Third World Feminist Scholarship and Activism that said, we have many ways of being positioned, and we are trying to struggle with what comes up first. But there is never a sense of privileging, just an acknowledgement of our matrix of domination. So I was just wanting to offer another paradigm.
So let me just summarize the two questions. Those are great questions. And I think they are related in the sense that one very important shift has to do with the what you've described as revolutionary content, aspirations, goal of first order Chicano art, and how that's evolved in terms of how the political geography has changed in the present. And it seems to me that this, I'll let the panelists answer, but in one sense, you know, those overbearing terms of the subject, of the people, of the masses, of change in a certain way, or politics in a certain manner, have no longer hold. And so I think some of the artists, and the panelists will confirm it or refute, have found ways to be able to make political claims, social claims, that are precise with what Karen Mary was mentioning, this idea that subjectivity changes and is not so stable, monolithic as we had formerly thought it was, and that thanks to third world feminists, queer people of color critique, we've been able to rethink subject positions as sidelong, shifting, being able to be transformative, situational. These are just words that are coming up, in fact, from the three essays by Rita, Chan, and Howard in the catalog. So with that said, maybe you would like to continue the conversation.
I'm going to go with microart history, because my fear is that, with the first question, is that there's a false opposition being set up between the present and the past, that somehow this little geography is new and it's unfamiliar to us. And let's go back to Almonte and South Almonte in 1976 for a second. What was also being circulated by the same group of land of homeowners and businessmen, besides them wanting to ban graffiti? They were circulating a petition and inviting the U.S. Department of Immigration and Naturalization to do something to remove the quote-unquote illegals in El Monte, while also investigating voter registration. And what was their concern about quote-unquote the illegals, the undocumented in El Monte? The loss of manufacturing. So the relationship between globalization and the triple fences at the border and hybridization are all there in 1976. In fact, happening with, you know, years and decades before we generally think of what turned into 187 and 209 in this state. The roots of better theme, there's a clear connection, at least in the minds of the residents, between art, muralism, graffiti, undocumented workers, the loss of manufacturing, right, in the industrial core of the city of Los Angeles, and potential illegal voter registration as well. So democracy is a threat also.
Well, Chung, Andina here answered in many ways the way I was going to respond. It might indeed be a false opposition. But in that context, I'd like to just suggest something about location, because the works in this show are, like a lot of political art, meant to address a very specific kind of audience, an art audience, people who come to galleries and museums, people who understand some of the references, as well as expanding what that audience might be, right? Critically expanding what that audience might be. I just finished teaching a class on activist art since 1960, and I think what's really important to understand is that there isn't a single place for this kind of critical, if you will, revolutionary practice to take place. There is still a reason for people to gather in large groups and march and block traffic and actually do, if you will, radical interventions for political goals. And it could be that artists are part of that progress and that process and produce posters and engage with that particular kind of activity. But I think it's an error to suggest that the ideological revolutions that are trying to take place in these institutions that potentially have an important impact on people who then make decisions in the city or make decisions intellectually and academically aren't also part of the struggle, if you will. That it isn't a part of a very important kind of revolutionary practice to engage in this space as well. And I think that that is also potentially a false opposition that comes up. But I really enjoyed your question because I think it does invite us to try to understand what are the possibilities for critique in the present? Where are the locations for critique in the present? And are those sufficient? Are they actually producing what the results that we'd like to see? And I can only say I would like to see more.
I think a lot of, I mean, you've answered a lot of my question already, but I'm interested in this idea of spaces, but in this case, the university and the art school, and how, you know, in the 70s, most of the artists were coming out of the streets or from their, you know, upbringing, because I was very also a little, I could say, shocked that so many of these artists in the exhibit negated that they had you know, that they're not Chicano artists, that they are, you know, and I'm wondering if, or that even that in a way negated the history. So again, there's that happening. And again, I'm wondering if, I mean, I think I know that most of that is coming through the fact that most artists today are going to these schools and universities and a lot of the art departments, you know, they have to, again, reinvent themselves. Through the art system or the university system. We can talk about that a little bit.
I think the question of the art school is a very important one that could lead to another panel in its entirety. Any speculative remarks?
Well, the history there, briefly, I mean, this is the, one of the differences that we're seeing that's generational and obviously has had an impact aesthetically is the possibility of Latinos to go to these art schools, both state and private. I mean, the history within Chicano art history is very clear. The real first generation, mass generation of artists that are able to go to art school are doing so directly as a result of the GI Bill. So it's specifically male, and it's veterans of the conflicts in Korea, largely. So that's the first generation of you know, recognizable generation of Chicano artists. And then by the late 60s and the early 70s, the artists are not necessarily veterans, right? Because of the complex around the conflicts in Southeast Asia, they're finding ways to not serve in military service in the many of them in the United States. And I think there's a moment where that aperture for art school education as a result of serving in the military closes down, and that's where the role of the community-specific art spaces, Galería de la Raza, Mexicano, and Royal Chicano Air Force in Sacramento, and throughout the Southwest, that's where those community art centers, galleries, centros become, and the grupos become so vital, because those become, in many ways, the art schools, where the trained artists and the not trained come together to generate and create art and become artists. Then it changes. But the numbers of Latino and Chicano students in art schools have been increasing quite steadily, and that's we see that in the show.
And I think some of the ambivalence of being in art school is reflected in some of the work, right? Because on the one hand, and there's art schools and there's art schools, that is, they have certain tonalities around their curriculum. But those that are invested in avant garde practices, for example, it's always a double consciousness. It's a very fine dance, being avant garde or invested in post structuralist practices, and also having a very specific story that points to markers of ethnicity, class, and race. So that these are being navigated by artists. Oftentimes, those ambivalences on the part of peers or faculty are very productive because they come up with responses to that, often using humor and the hyper genres, mixed media, to be able to address those that question.
And if I may,
yes, okay. Just really quickly. Sorry. At the same time, with you know, professors in the art schools as well, just wanted to give you another example. So not only is Sandra de la Loza on the Cultural Research Society, which she learned about through Delilah Montoya's class in Chicano art at UCLA through the work of OSCO. So it's influenced by OSCO through the teaching of one of the artists in the show teaching at Cal State LA. But also an artist, Xavier Cha, who's in the One Way or Another exhibition at the Japanese American Japanese American National Museum, has also been influenced by the work of Osko after taking courses with me at the Rhode Island School of Design, and that comes through in her topiary tags, which I encourage you all to see, which then play a rip-off of spray paint LACMA and the Asshole mural as well. So there's also this way in which the Chicano and Latino art from the earlier periods and the present are having a much broader impact than beyond just Chicano and Latino potential art students.
I think just in some ways to answer that last question and then the gentleman before that, but you know, I don't know how maybe a useful strategy to think about it is what Jose Munoz proposes as this disidentification. So to disidentify is not necessarily negating that history or that, in this case, Chicano, being a Chicano artist, but in fact it's a strategy, right? It's a strategy of survival. Because you're aware of how you're looked at, and I like that you said the double consciousness, but you're not accepting that perception of it. You're actually going to challenge it or offer new interpretations of that. And so maybe to think about it as a disidentification that many of these artists are actually operating with that model. And if you think about in terms of Tomás Ibarra Frausto and the revolutionary, I love what he says that the Chicano art project or the Chicano creative act, it centers on volition, remembrance, and discovery. And so in many ways, the artists that we see in that exhibition do exactly the same thing. So it's not that they're not Chicano art, but in fact are showing us their own processes of remembrance and discovery and that will to create the work in the way that they do and what we end up seeing in Phantom Sightings.
Our next question.
My name is Nate A. Rodriguez, and I'm an artist, and kind of wanted to talk a little bit about this whole notion of identity. And I think with a lot of the artists that I've talked to in relation to the show, some of the things that, you know, many people say was they're not identifying with being Chicano. I think what's happened is that our generation, this generation, we're looking at things from a different perspective. As Reina was talking about, showing our own process, and part of it is how we're viewing identity. Identity being something that is not fixed, that continues to evolve as we come in contact with different cultures, and realizing that the idea that looking at labels as being something that is a colonial construct, if you could say. So viewing that, we realize the importance of a lot of these labels, the importance of being able to have, Cornel West talks about being able to have this thing that we could identify and come together and challenge a lot of the civil injustices that occurred during a particular moment in time. But at the moment, some of the artists view it more like, well, unfortunately, I have to fall into this category. I have to fall into these particular labels. Not to say that I'm ashamed of the tribe that I was born into, but there is this notion that I have to fall into a particular category in order to function in a particular be historicized in some sense, you know. So I believe that artists are looking at it quite differently, in realizing that there are problems with many labels that we have been accustomed to using. You know, I mean, you guys are historians. We could break down Latino. We could break down Hispanic. We could break down Chicano. Each one of those terms has its history, and some of us really want our work to be used. To be viewed as, well, you know, I'm an artist. Why is it that, you know, you know, Klaus Wittenberg or, you know, Robert Rauschenberg does this? Well, I'm a white artist, you know. And part of that is really saying, you know what, this is our process. You know, this is how we're functioning as artists at this moment. That's not to say that we think Chicano's a horrible thing, you know, but to say that in this generation, this is the way we're approaching the way we create art in our own process. That's
well, I think you described this ambivalence that artists are having to navigate. And also, I've always loved the work of Adrian Piper as a writer, because she talks about the fact that, you mentioned Oldenburg, that we sort of make invisible, to go back to that metaphor of invisibility. We act as if what we know is the canon of American art history is not culturally specific, right? It's made invisible, it's naturalized, and it just takes a the work of artists and writers together to just change that optic. Mm-hmm. Did you have a question coming up? And no, while you're getting ready, Jennifer was going to respond.
Oh, I just wanted to really thank the last speaker because I think the problem that he identifies is not of just, as you mentioned or suggested, this sort of younger generation. I think this is a very long problem in art production and the history of art, the way in which the subject is constrained by the markings of his or her identity into a certain semiotic noose, right? And I think art historians and academics are as complicit in that construction as the powers that be that enforce a certain kind of racial division and racial marking. And I think what has to happen is a wider variety of kinds of analyses of works that is now taking place, I think, in a more complex way, where ideally the work is the place where the work takes place, and the subject who produces the work is not automatically read in relationship to that work. And while I think that that's an important move, I don't want to give up the possibility that for some artists, this heritage, the set of questions, these identities, are interwoven with the kind of process that they're engaging in. And I'll stop there.
You've been a very great audience. We have one more question. Just bear be patient. Oh, we've got a few questions. This means I make it disciplined later because we're going a little bit over, but with your consent, we'll have two more questions.
Yes.
Great. Good.
All right. I was really liking the fact that this panel is sort of getting to the question of the emissions and the canons and those types of issues. As an art historian, those are things I'm invested in, of course. But I was also I'm also curious that one of the tensions I find in the show that I find really productive is this question of the evidence, a type of phantom sighting, right? A type of document that gets left, and a sort of urge towards a sort of community, collaborative workspace in the city, right? This type of thing acting out. And I'm wondering about, you know, if you think about what's happening globally in terms of the art world, right? Istanbul or Inside or any of the other sort of larger formats, the questions about community engagement, collaboration, working in the city, working with different community groups, type of sort of political agency through collectivity, seems to be very much on the radar. It's not something that gets discussed within this community so much in contemporary art practices in a way that I think it should be. And that's, of course, all up to us to sort of re-engage that issue. And I'm wondering if the panel could talk a little bit about what you think should happen or certain questions that should be raised, methodologies that could be brought out to re-engage the questions of collaborative community art practices within this type of form.
But it's after seeing the show, what kinds of questions can be asked of what comes next in terms of collaboration.
Right.
We'll take the next question and then we'll answer those.
I really enjoyed the exhibition and the way it engages people, not just to come see it, but to really the works just really engage you. And I really enjoyed the panel today and the sophisticated conversation that's taking place, which. But it leaves me with the overriding question, which is what I started with when I walked into the show, and that is why we have this subtext, the subtitle of Art After the Chicano Movement, because I expected to see a very different exhibition walking in than I saw, you know, that I experienced as I walked out of it. And I think a lot of people, those of us who are not academics, those who are just viewers, had an impression of what this exhibition was going to be about. And in a way, it seemed to me that there was a subversion of what the intent originally seemed to have been by politicizing the show in having that subtitle. And I'm just very confused about that at this point.
Can you say quickly what you expected?
I expected Art After the Chicano Movement. What I saw was the triumph of the Chicano movement.
Oh. All right, so this is an interesting point. What has to do with expectations? That is upwardly or downward expectations. And then and the question prior to that, which is that what might come next? So they are tied.
I think the show, and I'm glad to hear that. I mean, for me also, it's less about this kind of modernist break or rupture or determination, but more about the preposition after, as subsequent to, and then consequence of. That's what I keep thinking of, that the after the Chicano movement, that it's actually about an ongoing dialogue, an ongoing negotiation, and also it's about the opening of that supposed closure. But it's doing it by, and that's very important and provocative for me. Use of that preposition there with regard to the work that's actually in the show.
I mean, I think it was very purposefully done to use the open-endedness of after, which is to say that what of the past needs to elide so that the future can exist, right? Something's going to be left over and something's going to open up, right? And I think that's what after allows.
No, I agree. I think it is about an opening. It's not about a closure in it. And I find it interesting, in some of the conversations that I heard on Wednesday at the opening, you know, the sense of like, oh my God, after, that means we're over. And it's like, oh no. I do agree. But, and maybe it's just me being optimistic. But I love that idea of openness, you know, because some of these artists, again, like I was said in the opening, you are very mindful of the history of the Chicano movement, are directly involved with some of those who were very actively involved in some of the work produced, and are engaging with that conversation, and it's not like, you know, it's a continuum.
I think the prior question, and maybe we can leave that for the next session because we're running out of time, but the idea being that there are some collaborations that take place in the exhibition, but I think the question means just to the effect, well, what would it look like if actually artists were involved in policy changing, which may have been at the time in El Monte or something like that, right? So maybe we can ask the artists in our second session. And I want to thank you for your patience. I want to thank you for the great questions.